Okay, so I sent you the current snapshot of the gradebook, and if you have any missing points that, you know, you should bring it up to the notice of my, to either my or TA's notice later, at the end of the class we can take. And then, so there, as I said, there is a, so actually I also sent a mail about homework 4, which is going to be due when, like next Monday, next Tuesday, yeah. So that includes the NIVACE classifier stuff. And then the last homework would be essentially about things that we will start next class, okay, onwards, which is basically the structure on the web. Okay, and then the project last part has already been given. We talked about it, I think, last time. And then there is going to be a demo with respect to the project that you have to sign up. Questions? Yes.
So how does the we're doing cluster grading? How does the extra credit for the project sway into that?
What if you are? I still don't get the first part. If you're doing clustering.
Well, you're doing grading by clustering, like, so, you know, that's like top, you know, people, top cluster is like an A, second cluster is like a B, right?
Oh, first of all, I mean, this is a counterfactual question. You have no idea what I do to give grades. So, and you will find out way too late, and, you know, what I do. So, no, I, as I said, the only thing I did say is, you know, I would essentially take extra credit into account only at the very end, after I've made up my mind as to what the effective grade thresholds are. And the effective grade thresholds can be found by after you cluster, you can say that to the difference between the clusters is the threshold. No.
Okay.
No, if I do, then essentially I'm looking at it.
Well,
so,
yeah, that's
so this is, it's triple blind or whatever grading. So I'm not looking at your, not looking at what the impact of your extra credit would be on your grade. No, I don't do it until the very last minute. Okay. But as to how I actually convert numbers into grades, it's a trademark secret stuff. Okay. But irrespective of what I say, it ultimately the teachers decide what the grades are, right? Because even if I were to say 90 and above is A, it doesn't mean a thing because I get to set the exams, right? So it's not really, I don't think it's any more subjective than any other class you have taken. So you don't need to worry about it as much. It's just that you might know in another class, if you are not 90, you know for sure you won't get an A. That's about it. Here you might still. Yes.
The previous classes, typically how many students get A?
I don't know.
Is it possible to get the statistics?
I don't know. I can try to look it up. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So what I am going to do today is complete the discussion on classification learning and then go into recommendation systems and hopefully complete the recommendation systems today so that we can start talking about structure on the web next class onwards, but we might, you know, go into next class or in with on the recommendation system. Okay, so we were talking about NBC. I'm basically just going to quickly review what you already said, that in essence by making a huge assumption about how to compute. So, let me see. So you need to compute the probability of the example given CI. So we are actually looking for probability that a particular example, a test data, belongs to a class. Using the Bayes network, Bayes rule, you try to estimate that in terms of probability of class given example is estimated in terms of probability of example given class times probability of class by probability of example. And of these, this you don't care because you really only care about which class is more likely. And if you are computing probability of C1 given E and probability of C2 given E, both of them would have the same normalizing factor of probability of the example. So the probability of example is not needed as far as you're concerned. Probability of class is just the prior probability of that particular class. I mean, in the distribution of the data, the prior probability that, you know, there would be examples of this class in the data. Okay, and the most interesting part, of course, is probability of example given class. You think of the example as a conjunction of features, okay, or attributes, and you assume that the attributes are independent, completely independent, which is similar to the assumption we made about the dimensionality in the vector space. All dimensions are independent. And if you were to make that assumption, then the probability of this, E given ECI, is probability that attribute 1 is V1, attribute 2 is V2, etc., attribute K is VK, given CI, which by the assumption of independence will become probability of A1 given V1, A1 equal to V1 given CI, times probability of A2 equal to V2 given CI, and so on. Okay, and you have to understand, if you have not thought about naive Bayes classification before, if you haven't thought about learning before, I hope you completely understand the fact that that makes our life significantly easier, because as I said last time, if you have about 10 attributes, if you have 10 Boolean attributes, then this, going with this, requires that you need n times 2 power 10. Where n is the number of classes and 2 power 10 is the number of possible examples that you can get with 10 Boolean attributes. So you would wind up needing these many probabilities from the data. Okay, and normally you don't get that much training data. And so if you are estimating large number of parameters and from the small amount of training data, most of those estimates are likely to be bogus. Okay. And in fact, many of them are likely to be zeros, because it turns out that in the training data, that particular example doesn't exist. And so what do? You will assume it's zero. Okay. So then instead, what we are going by is you're going in terms of AI equal to VI given CJ. Okay. And so these, only one for each attribute, assuming these are Boolean attributes, for each attribute you would need how many numbers? For each attribute class combination you need one number, because for that particular class either this attribute is going to be true or it's going to be false. Okay, so instead of going for n times 2 power 10, you're going to n times k, where k is the number of attributes. This is the number of parameters you need to estimate from the data. Okay, and the fewer the parameters you need to estimate, the more more effective the estimate is going to be. Okay, so then once, and in terms of estimating these parameters, it's obvious as to get this number P. So for example, probability that attribute K is true given class J, all you need is among the training data you count all the examples in the training data which are belonging to class J. Okay, number of examples in training data belonging to class J. Okay, and among those you find the number which have AK equal to true. So the ones with AK equal to true among these. So that's the probability. Okay? So what you wind up doing essentially is, and this is what we were showing, for this example we were showing that You would essentially need the PCIs, which is the prior probability of the classes themselves, that is of this type, and you will need these kinds of probabilities, probabilities that patterns equal to full given will weight equal to S, and that would be the number of examples which had will weight equal to S is 6. Among those, two of them had patterns equal to full, so it's 2 over 6, 0.333. This was the number. Once you have these numbers, then computing, given a new example, computing its class posterior is essentially looking at that example because of the Bayes rule. So you have a new example, E new, which has A1 equal to true and A2 equal to false. In fact, one of the interesting things about naive Bayes in terms of this naive Bayes classifier is that the new example doesn't have to be completely specified. You say an example is completely specified if you know all its attributes and their values. Okay, if I only know some of the attribute values and the others I don't know, I can still use that evidence to figure out what is the posterior, what is the best guess as to what class this example belongs to. Yes, yes. They're not, I just assume. How are you going to decide that the keywords are independent? We didn't. I mean, we could. We did the LSI, which was later on, but we also found that the independence assumption seems to be getting us along fine. I will talk a little bit about how to reduce the independence assumption, but the more interesting point is even with this very strong independence assumption, naive Bayes classifier works quite well. I forgot to mention this last time. I think about 3 years back or 4 years back when I went to this Google faculty summit, somebody was asking Peter Narvig, who was at that time the research head, machine learning research head for Google, so what does Google do for the machine learning? He said naive Bayes classification. Well, of course, they do much more than that now, but naive Bayes classification, you know, is like the first thing you will try. And it's pretty good for most of the, if you had nothing to go with, you know, what you can get with naive Bayes classification for text classification is quite impressive. Okay. So what's more interesting is even with this huge independence assumption, NBC works fine. And I mentioned again last class as to why that might be true. You know, intuitively, part of the reason that might be true is naive Bayes classifiers make horrendously wrong predictions on the true posterior. But what matters to you is not the true posterior, but the relative values. Remember I said, suppose you know, you have only two classes, C1 and C2. Okay, the true posterior for a particular example, E nu, the true posterior, by the way, the word posterior, if you haven't heard about, if you haven't been in probability classes before, posterior is the distribution after you take evidence into account. Okay, so the true posterior may be 0.63 and 0.37, let's say. That's the distribution. Okay, that's the true posterior. But let's say naive Bayes got 0.95, 0.05. Obviously, this is an ugly approximation to this, and this is a really ugly approximation to this. And yet, if you were given this as the distribution, what would be the most likely class? C1. If you're given this, what would be the most likely class? C1. So both of you would come to the same exact conclusion. So in this particular case, actually, this is the most likely class, and the wrong distribution will still give the same answer. Okay, that's one of the reasons why naive Bayes seems to work well in practice. Okay, so as I said, if I just have a new example, which all I know about that example is patterns equal to full, nothing else. Okay, then the probability that will weight equal to yes given patterns equal to full is probability of patterns equal to full given will weight equal to yes times this by this. Okay, and you know this number because you computed this, you know this number because you estimated this. This one is a normalizing constant. Think of 1 over this as k. Okay, then will weight equal to no would have essentially the same kind of expression with the same denominator. And so all you care about is comparing the two numbers and see which is bigger. Okay, because both of them are being multiplied by the same positive constant. Okay, so that's naive Bayes classification. Now, this in itself is reasonable enough. The one question is, remember I talked about the estimation of probabilities, and I said if you really did not make the independence assumption, you will wind up asking for probabilities such as what is the probability that, you know, the following example will happen given that you are in class C1. Okay, the example is A1 has the value V1, A2 has the value V2, etc., AK has the value VK. Now, your training data may not actually give any information on that, and so most of these numbers become zeros. Okay, but suppose now we actually have, instead of asking that such a very constrained query, we are asking what's just the probability, how many of the training examples in class C1 happen to have A7 equal to true? Instead of saying A7 equal to true, A5 equal to false, A1 equal to true, etc., so many extra constraints. Okay, that basically means there are more like, you're more likely to actually get a better estimation. Overall, the bigger issue, of course, is in computing these probability numbers from the training examples. A big issue is how biased are the estimates going to be. Okay, so think of the following question. Suppose you are trying to estimate, so I picked up a coin from my pocket and I start tossing in front of you. Okay, now you're trying to estimate from the outcomes of this coin toss that I've shown you, what is likely to be the outcome of a new coin toss. That's the learning problem, right? So I just picked up a coin and I tossed it twice and it came heads both times. My question now is, I'm about to toss it the third time. What do you think is the probability that it'll come heads the third time? Remember that you don't know anything about my coin, right? All you have seen is the training examples. Okay, to compute that probability, so you need to get basically when I have a coin toss, there is a parameter for the coin toss, which is the probability of heads. And 1 minus probability of heads equals to probability of tails. Right? So when you are seeing me tossing a coin, the big issue for you is computing this parameter from the training data. Once you compute this parameter, then when I ask you, okay, I'm about to toss it again, what do you think is the probability that it will come heads? You just tell me P heads. If I ask you what's the probability that the next four would be heads, you would say P heads times P heads times P heads times P heads, four times. Right? Okay. The question, of course, is based on the examples, you need to estimate this parameter, probability of heads. This is not unlike based on the examples, you had to estimate what is the probability that the word Viagra exists given that the class is spam, or what is the probability that the word RAL exists given that the class is spam. That also you're computing from the training data. Okay, so in this particular case, if you just went by looking at the number of examples that are provided to you, what would you say is the probability of heads coming? After the first two tosses, both times it came heads. 100%. So if you went just by that, you should have assumed that probability of heads equal to 1, probability of tails equal to 0. So when I toss the coin next time, the probability that it will come tails is 0, according to you. But would you do that? Forget about what you talked about in a naive Bayes classification. Would you do that yourself? Would you bet that the third time the coin will not come tails at all? Okay? And compare this to this other question, which is the same experiment, except now in front of you, I toss my coin 3,000 times. 3,000 times, and it comes heads all 3,000 times. Now, would you be more comfortable in saying that the p tails equal to 0? My assumption is most of you would be very happy to say probability of tails equal to 0 in this case without any worry, whereas you are kind of not too sure at this point. Why? Because the data, the training data is not big enough. In particular, what happens is, well, of course, well, training data is not big enough, but there is also a bigger issue, which is when I say a coin, you have seen coins in your life. You have seen coins in your life, and you have an expectation on what is the probability of heads for coins. Okay? You have a prior belief, prior on probability of heads. And what happens is you try to stick to your prior, but you will be forced to give up the prior as the examples keep showing you that your prior is wrong. With just one pass, if you throw away your prior, that means you are easily, it's easy to mess with your brain. Okay, so you're ready to give up your prior, you know, beliefs very fast. Okay, in general, what we do, because when we have small number of examples and you still need to learn, is we have strong priors, we have background knowledge. You know, this is not the first time we came into the world. We have seen coins before. And based on that, we try to have an idea as to what the parameter's value is likely to be, and then look at the evidence and change the parameter's value slightly. As again as our example, our discussion in this previous case, where you assume you have no prior at all. All you know about this problem is what is in this data. Okay, so the right way to do this kind of probability estimation, it turns out, is to use the priors that you have for the problems, if you happen to have them. But many a time, you don't have easy access to what should be the prior on some arbitrary parameter. Just a second. Okay, so basically, in fact, in probabilistic learning, in statistical learning frameworks, this idea of taking prior into account is the full Bayesian learning, and this is for people who actually may have heard about this before, full Bayesian learning or map learning. And what we tried to show in the previous case is essentially just ignoring all the prior, so it just assumes data is the key. Okay, now what's interesting is if the data is large enough, then you assume that all the priors will be overridden by the data. When the data is small, you should not change your mind too quickly just based on the fact that the first pass became, you know, I mean, the first two tosses became heads. You shouldn't assume that this coin must have been doctored by Rao and it is actually just a both sides heads coin. Right? So the question then is, we need to do this for naive Bayes classifier too. And the bigger question is, if I do not do this to naive Bayes classifier, what do I pay? What I pay is zeros. One of the problems in the way naive Bayes, one of the problems in which you're using these numbers is, of course, you're multiplying the parameters you estimated. What is 29 times 35 times 8 times 0 times 48 times 98 times 98? Zero. You get one zero, you get a whole big zero. Okay? Now, what's the probability that one of the parameters you are estimating is likely to be zero if you do it this way? Very high. Because if the training data is small, it is actually possible that, you know, if the training data is small, it is actually possible that probability that attribute 7 will be true given the class spam would be estimated to be 0 just because you only have, no, class less than non-spam would be estimated to be 0 because you have too few non-spam mails in your training data. And so because of which you will wind up saying, you know, there are total of 3 non-spam mails in my mailbox and none of them have A7 equal to true. So A7 equal to true, you know, given this, would be zero probability. Okay. Another way of actually getting a intuition for this is, think about, you know, this is also similar to, for example, suppose you're trying to compute this probability. What's the probability that spleen will have malignant growth, given you have Ebola? Okay, this is the same thing. You know, basically, you are using symptoms to compute the causes. Okay, you are using the words in a file to compute what was the character of the file. Okay, the spam, once you decide you're going to make spam mail, presumably you're putting more words of a certain type. That is the assumption. Okay, so if you can do naive-based classification for disease classification. So somebody comes in and then they'll tell you what their symptoms are, and you have to decide whether they have, what is the prior probability, what's the posterior on the various diseases. Do they have Ebola, do they have flu or common cold, etc., etc., etc. Now, one of the probabilities you will need is spleen will have malignant growth given Ebola. Now, if you just randomly take 100 people from Tempe as your training example, what is the possibility that even one of them will have Ebola? Big zero. Okay, if you take a large number, maybe you'll get a few who have Ebola. So the number of people with Ebola itself is very small. And that may not be able to catch the whole range of Ebola manifestations. So maybe suppose about 1% of the people with Ebola, I mean maybe 20% of the people with Ebola will have this spleen with malignant growth. And you only have 2 Ebola patients in your training data. So it's very likely that you will have 0 of the patients with Ebola having spleen malignancy. So you would assume this probability is zero. It looks like a reasonable thing, except arithmetic is evil, and if you have a zero is forever, right? A zero is forever. You want to avoid zeros. From a practical point of view, if one of your parameters becomes zero, it just takes part in the multiplication, everything, the whole thing, essentially the whole learning task is out. Okay, so you could understand, so both of these require, I basically came to this slide from 2 different ways. One is, you probably want to not just depend upon the examples, you might want to take into account some notion of prior. Okay, the second one is that in fact if you do not, many of your parameters could be zeros and you'll die, because essentially you'll get whole bunch of zeros as a product, and so you will not be able to distinguish. So for both of these, one idea, of course, the right idea is to have the prior, okay, but that's hard most of the time. Instead, there is an idea that people use called Laplacian smoothing, which essentially says when you are trying to compute probability that ith attribute will have jth value given some class, previously you used to say look for the number of instances with that class in the training data, and then put that in the denominator and put among those number of instances how many of them have AI equal the attribute having that value. Put that in the numerator. So this red by red is what you were computing before. What you do to smooth this estimate is you act, basically you can do it in 2 different ways. One way is to say, since this could be zero and zero by something will be zero, so you add a little number here and a little number here. Okay, now from a just an asymptotic point of view, if the number you added to the numerator is small, then you just make sure that it won't become zero. The numerator won't become zero. If you have a large number of training examples, then eventually this number would be larger than this number. So for a large number of training examples, this little trick you did would still not change the true probability. For the small number, it makes sure that you don't get zeros. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is, what I'm actually doing is, I only had about these many examples in my training data for class C. I go ahead and make m extra virtual examples, okay, to the denominator. Now then, among these m virtual examples, I need to decide how many of them will have ai equal to vi. I would assume, basically, that's where I'll use my prior. Okay, so if I don't know anything, I will just assume that, so this m is the number of virtual examples for class C, and m times p is the number of those examples that also happen to have AI equal to VI. Now the question, of course, is what is p? If you don't know anything, you might say that if an attribute AI has two values, I'll just assume it occurs with half and half probability. Both those values will occur with half and half probability. If I happen to know something more, saying true is more likely than false, then I will say p equal to 2/3. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. This is a very simple idea. This is called m estimates, and it's m because you're adding m virtual samples in the bottom, and then the fraction of those virtual samples having that particular attribute value in the top. Okay, and it has multiple ways of understanding why you came here. One is basically you're kind of thinking of this as providing the effect of having the prior. Okay, so that as the number of examples increase, this effect of this goes away. For small number of examples, you won't shift, you know, from a default coin being fair to a default coin being completely biased just because you saw two examples of it coming heads twice. Okay? So this, if I do this, then essentially I would have, the explanation as to why this makes sense is what took me all this while. Okay? But just doing this is no big deal. You already were getting this number, I'm just asking you to add two dummy numbers on top and bottom. So that, you know, if their effect is that it's going to change the ratio a little bit so that it'll never become zero, because this would not be zero, so numerator will not be zero. Okay, and then it will become closer to what the true value of this by this should have been if in fact the number of training examples of that class is large enough. Okay, so this, you should do this, in fact, and then if you are using text data, we will look at how to do the, you know, for the text files, and which is what you are interested in, what you assume is basically if there is, you know, you will say m equal to the, let's see, so we assume m equal to v, which is the size of the vocabulary, and p equal to 1 over v. That means the probability that a particular word occurs in the file is 1 over v. If you pick it this way, then you will always add size of vocabulary to the denominator and you add 1 to the numerator. That's the default thing that people try for the text classification. Okay. Remember that it has this feel of ad hocness because I'm making up virtual samples and giving them some probabilities, you know, as to what, which fraction of them will have the required attribute value valuation. But the reason we are doing this is essentially because otherwise we would be too tempted to go with just a couple of examples we have and change our entire mind. Okay, so that's basically an estimate. And I've been discussing most of these ideas with text in the background and, you know, general attributes and their valuations in the foreground. So if I'm actually using text files, how do you do naive-Bayes classification? Well, you know, obviously you have some of the ideas, you know, but I just want to go through some details. So the idea is you will assume now that a text document is a set of attributes and their values. That's what you want to look at it as. Okay, so now I can say that the text document has, what are the attributes in the text document? One simple idea is to say a text document has positions. position 1, position 2, position 3, which are all the word positions. A document of 1500 words has 1500 positions. So each attribute is a position. Okay? And the value of that attribute can be a vocabulary word. Okay? So a file can now be seen, probability of document given class C is probability that P1 equal to W1 and P2 equal to W2, etc. The length of the document, PL equal to WL, given class C. So this is your conjunctive probability. Okay? Now you need to reduce this into a set of independent probabilities. So the first thing I'll assume is word independent, word probability, words occur in positions independent of each other. Just the word NBC did. So this conjunction then becomes the multiplication. This probability of B given C will now be probability that in the position 1 you will get W1 given C, times position 2 you will get W2 given C, times in position L you will get WL given C. Now I'll make one more assumption, which was not needed previously, which is a reasonable assumption, which is, so remember, if you do it this way, the number of probabilities I will wind up needing is for every position and every word and every class. Right? Because this is what I'm looking for. These numbers are for each position. In the position 1, what's the probability that word 1 occurs, given that it's the spam mail? In the position 1, what's the probability that word 2 occurs, given that it's a spam mail, and so on. These are the probabilities you want. It's still too many because the probability that the word occurs in position 1 is different from the probability that the same word occurs in position 2. It can be different in general. Okay? But in the bag of words model, we ignore that. Right? In the bag of words model, we ignore that. We assume that a word occurring anywhere in the file is the same. Okay? So then I will make one more assumption saying probability that word 1 occurs in position 1 given C is the same that it occurs in position 2 given C is the same that it occurs in position L given C. If that is the case, then having all that matters is how many times did the word occur. If the word occurred 5 times, then essentially it's that probability exponentiated to power 5. Okay? Once you do that, with this, now we are in a good shape. All you will wind up needing is the probability that a word occurs given class CI is the number of times the word K is occurring in the CI class, and in the bottom, of course, is the number of instances of class CI in the training data, and then this 1 and this V are the M estimates. That is basically, you assume that each word, so you take V, the virtual samples, V is the vocabulary size, virtual samples, and you assume each word occurs normally with 1 over V probability. Okay, so that's basically this probability. Okay, so. And again, you just count the number of words. The number of WKCI is the number of times word K appears in the documents classified into class CI, and WCI is the total number of words in all documents of class CI. Okay, that's this. Okay? So this is basically what I'm using for the text data. Okay, the only additional assumption I made is the word being present in any position is the same as the word being present in the file at all. Okay? That's sort of what bag of words model also does. Okay? Questions? Okay. So if you do this, actually, this is basically a reasonable estimate. So for example, as an example, if you classify Usenet articles from 20 different groups, So you have an example article can belong to any of 20 possible different Usenet groups. Okay, and so if you just randomly guess, your random guessing will give you 5% accuracy because they're 1 over 20. Okay, but using naive-based classification and with this model, you can get upwards of 89% accuracy, which is not bad. Okay, so this actually is, you know, whatever I showed in this slide, then this slide is the training phase, which is keeping these numbers together, and in the testing phase, given a new file, you're computing its class given the stored parameter. You can look at this, okay, to make sure that you got the computation right. Okay. One other thing before we move on from here is feature selection, which is sort of related to, are the words really independent of each other? Okay, or in particular, how important is each attribute to the classification you're about to make? Okay, and so rather than take, so in naive-based classification, you assume essentially all the attributes are important, all the words are important. Okay, suppose some of the words really are not relevant to making this classification. Then can I reduce the number of features by only looking at the features? When I say features, the attributes are the words. Okay, can I reduce them such that only the ones relevant to making the classification are considered? The assumption, for example, is suppose I define people in the class in terms of huge number of attributes, you know, like their IQ value, their high school GPA, their hair length, their hair color, their nose size, et cetera, et cetera. And the training data is what is their GPA above 3.5 or below 3.5. That's the training data. And then given a new student described in the same description, I'm supposed to guess whether their training data, whether their GPA is likely to be more than 3.5 or less than 3.5. Okay. Clearly, I think some attributes you would agree are irrelevant to this classification. So for example, the nose size. Unless you have a great theory of, you know, intelligence, probably nose size is irrelevant to your GPA. So is probably your hair length. Okay. The question is, can I figure this out without knowing anything about the domain? Okay, you in the domain of students and their GPA, you have a background theory. You have your own pet theory as to what makes people have more than 3.5 GPA versus less than 3.5 GPA. Based on that, you remove a whole bunch of features, irrelevant features from consideration and stick to some of the relevant ones. The question is, if I give you all these attributes and just the training data, could you yourself figure out what attributes are actually relevant and what are irrelevant? Okay, and if you do that, then the idea would be that rather than take all features into account, take, let's say, K features. Top K features that are somehow most relevant to the classification task, and only use them in the naive-based classification. Okay, to cut to the chase, here is a picture which shows you, you know, for a variety of naive-based classifiers. In fact, you know, I think the variety of naive-based classifiers with a variety of feature selection ideas, okay, one of which I'll describe in a minute, if you just take the top one feature, top 10 features, top 100 features, top 1,000, top 10,000 features. In learning, in using the training data. And then when you get the test data, now remember that you decided that the hair color isn't important when you learned the probabilities. So when I give you the test data with somebody whose hair color is like flaming red, you just ignore that information. Because according to you, that is not part of, that's not a relevant attribute. Okay? And so you only use the relevant attributes in doing the classification. And if you do this classification, then if you compute the accuracy of the classification, as the number of features you are using is increased, okay, if you take too few features, unless the one feature you took happens to be what is their GPA, it's unlikely that one feature would be completely predictive of everything about the training data. So if you take too few features, you sort of expect that the accuracy will be low. you are also not surprised that as the number of features increase, the accuracy increases. What's interesting is as you take too many features, the accuracy worsens. Which, if this doesn't exist, then I shouldn't have to teach you anything about feature selection, right? Because then you will just use everything. And see, let the data be its own arbiter. You know, if in fact the hair color doesn't wind up being right, wind up being relevant for the hair color doesn't, is not relevant for the GPA, then NBC should somehow figure that out itself. Why isn't it doing it? Why do I have to do a pre-processing step and tell NBC that don't even bother about this? Again, part of the problem, it turns out, is the size of the training data is small enough that many of these extraneous attributes, you are basically doing this M estimate correction to all these extraneous attributes. And whether they're relevant or not, those corrections will wind up being taken into account in doing the overall classification, because you're multiplying them into the classifier. Okay? And so that's sort of the way they become noisy, and that noisy attributes are worsening the classification. Before I go off from this slide, notice what I wrote there, and what I didn't write. I mean, this is actually in the book. This is a picture from the IR book that you have access to. So this one is F measure. When was the last time we heard about F measure? When we combined precision and recall. Remember? So now why is F measure coming in classification? Well, you can do it this way. Suppose you are trying to decide whether or not a mail is a spam mail. And I have a classifier which says this are spam mails. The precision of this classifier is the number of things it said are spam and the fraction of those which are really spam. So the fraction of the ones that your spam mailer said spam, which are really spam when you looked into it. That's the precision. The recall is the total number of spam mails in your entire mailbox and the ones that it actually saw as spam. You can increase recall by saying everything is spam, so you would never miss a spam mail. You can increase precision by not saying anything at all. And we know that to combine both, you take F measure, which is the harmonic mean between precision and recall. So that's what I'm comparing in this. When I'm comparing different classifiers, I'm basically comparing F measure with respect to the class of importance. Okay? And I notice that the F measure is higher in the middle, lower on both ends. Which means it would be nice if I can somehow figure out which attributes are relevant to the classification task at hand. That's the idea. Okay, so now go back to slides and say, what do I do? Well, the basic point that you want to understand is the following. So here is the data. Okay, and on the data, the classifier, let's say the spam mail, the feature, yes, spam, that is, you know, spam mail, it's distributed in some way. Some data are more likely to be spam, some data are less likely to be spam. Okay, now, given another feature, let's say a particular word in each of these text, okay, Viagra, okay, then I would want to know how is Viagra distributed on the data. Here is one way it could be distributed. Okay, another way it could be distributed is of those you could see that the first one which sort of tracked the class, that means Viagra is a very powerful indicator. Where this distribution is independent of the other distribution, it's not an indicator. The word independence comes in. So the question that I'm asking you is, given the data point, okay, I want to compare probability that the class is C and the attribute is A. 2, the probability that the class is C times attribute is A. If they are independent, then this will be equal to this. To the extent the joint probability is far enough from the product of the marginals, they are not independent. If they are not independent, there is indication in this feature as to whether or not the data under consideration is class. Data under consideration is of that class. So basically, when I say, you know, the hair color does not seem to matter for GPA, how did I come to that conclusion? It seems there are as many people with blonde hair in above 3.5 GPA as there are in below 3.5 GPA. And there are as many people with brown hair in above 3.5 GPA as in below 3.5. So essentially, there is no correlation between them. They're independent. So what you really want to compute is compute this difference between PC, probability, joint probability, and the two marginals product. So one way of computing this, essentially, remember you have to do this for all the valuations. So for example, if the hair color can be blonde, brown, and black, and GPA can be above 3.5, below 3.5, then I have to consider hair color blonde, above 3.5, hair color blonde, below 3.5, hair color black, above 3.5, below 3.5, hair color brown, above 3.5, below 3.5. All those probabilities have to be taken into account, okay? And so one way you define these, you know, basically remember that all I really care about is how probability, joint probability differs from this marginal product. And one way you can look at it is this measure called mutual information, okay? And it has the right behavior. Okay, what it does is it essentially takes log of the joint that the ith variable, ith attribute is true and in the class C. I mean, so in the training data, the number of data points which have both Xi is true and C is class is C. Okay, divided by probability of attribute having that value and probability of class having that value, independent of each other. If this is equal to this times this, then this ratio would be 1, log of 1 is 0. So multiply anything by 0, you'll still get 0, so that means mutual information would be 0. Otherwise, the information would be either positive or negative. Right? And then you are weighting that by the probability that Xi and C will have those valuations. Okay, if you then add these things up, then you will get the mutual information between a particular attribute and a particular class. Okay, then you can then decide, you can compute the mutual information for all the features this way, pick the top k features. That's how you would reduce, that's how you can then focus on just the relevant feature. Let me give you an example. Okay, again from the book, but this actually puts things in perspective. So again, this is still our formula. I'm using mutual information. By the way, how many of you have done 471? Okay, 471, remember decision trees?
What is 471?
Okay, you didn't do it then. So if you have done 471, you won't forget the number, especially if you did it with me. But 471 intro to AI. Basically, in decision trees, remember we talk about what questions, the decision trees, last time I talked about is the shibboleth idea, which is ask just 20 questions, a fewest questions to figure out whether the data point belongs to class X or class Y. Now, imagine I'm trying to play this 20 questions idea on students. I'm trying to guess their GPA. I have to ask the fewest questions possible. Okay? Should I start lead off by saying, what is the length of your nails? I shouldn't do it unless, in fact, I think length of nails are relevant to the class under consideration. So in doing Bayesian trees, we pick features one by one by one, and each feature you ask what is the evaluation of that feature. Remember, those of you who remember Bayesian trees. And you do that picking of the feature by using what's called information gain heuristic. What we're doing is that, essentially. So in fact, the idea that I'm describing here is pick the features using decision tree ideas, then rather than generate an actual decision tree, use naive-Bayes classifier with respect to these features to decide the classification of the new example that's coming in. If you remember, decision trees had this problem of not being particularly good with noisy data. And the way we are doing it, that's taken care of, because naive-Bayes classifiers are extremely good with noisy data. Okay, so that's a connection to those of you who remember Bayesian trees. But let's look at an example here. So I have apparently in this particular case, I'm interested in the class poultry, and the term is export. So I have a bunch of files, okay, and I'm trying to say these files are about poultry and these are not. And I will make this decision based on whether they have certain terms or not. So think of poultry as spam or not spam, okay? And the word export is like the word Viagra. Okay, now here are the numbers that you care about. Since export can be present or not present, and the particular file under consideration is either actually, in the training data, is either actually a poultry-related file or not poultry-related file, according to the training data. So then you get four possible, the total amount of training data can be split into four pieces. Okay, here is the class is poultry and the word export occurs in the file. Class is poultry, the word export doesn't occur in the file. Class is not poultry, the word export occurs in the file. Class is not poultry and the word export doesn't occur in the file. You need all four so that you get the full distribution, not just one point. Right? Okay. So now what do? I essentially to compute, and I will say export is irrelevant to poultry if in fact the distribution of export is sort of independent to the distribution of poultry. That's what I have in mind over the data. Okay. So mutual information for this word export with respect to the class poultry is, of course, as I said, take for each valuation of class and the attribute their joint probability times log of their joint probability by their marginal probabilities. Now notice that, so the joint probability for this one, for example, is export is 1, poultry is 1. So the probability that export is 1 and poultry is 1. That would be the total, the probability for that is, there are only total of 49 such examples. 49 is in the numerator. 801,948, what is this number? This number must be summation of all those four numbers. That's it. Okay, so that's this number. Okay, now log of, I need again the probability of this by probability of this and probability of this. Remember that the way you would actually have is the top one would be 49 by 49 by nothing is working here. Okay. 801K, right? The top one is 49 by 801K. And the bottom ones would be the probability that export occurs at all. Export occurs at all is this plus this, right? This plus this, which is 27,652 plus 49 plus 27K divided by 809K, right? Because the total number of examples times the probability of the class occurs at all. The class occurs at all is 49 here and 141 here. Okay, so 49 plus 141 by 801K. right? And then 1 800, I mean 809K. So 1 809K here, 1 809K here cancels out, one of them goes up. That's why I just have that number there. Okay, this is for one valuation. I have to take the second valuation, the third valuation, or the fourth valuation, and add them all up. In fact, those of you who have done Bayesian trees have a deja vu feeling, because this is the kind of numbers you are computing there too. Okay, and then you add these all up, and then this would basically say 0.0001105. That's the mutual information of the word export with respect to the class power tree. You do this for every other word. Sort them in the what order? Sort them in what order?
Decreasing.
What?
Decreasing.
Decreasing order, and pick the top K. Here's a question. Suppose the word computer science never occurs in a spam mail. Is the word computer science a good indicator in checking spam or not? Yes or no? Yes. Will, so that means it should have good information, because its absence signifies it's not spam. Right? You want to go home and make sure that this numbering, this way of computation, will still give computer science a high positive mutual information. That's something that you want to think about. Okay?
Sigma do
what?
What is the sigma do?
Basically, that's what this sigma, right? This is the probability that the attribute is true and the class is true, probability that attribute is true, class is false,
okay.
Attribute false, class true. That's what. So this sigma is expanded here into these four terms. This is, so in fact, chi-square is another approach for feature relevance. Okay? This is one way you can get relevance of the features. And so, for example, if you use this idea, in fact, if you go back to this, remember the word MI here. Wherever you see the word MI, those correspond to feature selection using mutual information. There is another idea called chi-square, another idea called frequency. There are tons of ideas for figuring out features, you know, which features are important. Okay, I'll give you one more other than just the one I already described, because it's relevant to latent semantic indexing and we already mentioned it previously. Okay, but the point is, if you do this and then you pick the top K, and as long as the K is a reasonable number, you seem to be doing better with the middle than taking all versus taking none. Okay, which is what feature selection is. Now, one question in doing this. Okay, so there was, I'm rapidly running out of my examples, but you took 471 with me, right? So remember, unfortunately, I just have to talk to you, but other people just, you know, vicariously live through her. But there was a question in my 471 exam normally about the Seinfeld prop, you know, parties. And what's a good party? And then you're trying to decide whether or not a party is good or bad based on the training examples. And the only thing you find is no individual feature is particularly indicative. But two features together are indicative. You know, for those of you who are into Seinfeld, you know, the way that example was made up was, if both Jerry and Newman are in the party, it would be a bad party. If only one of them are there, it's okay. But if both of them are there, the party would be bad. In such a case, what you will wind up having is feature dependencies. Do you understand what I'm saying? What I'm losing in computing feature relevance by individual features is I'm losing the feature dependencies. So enter, you know, people in feature selection have basically started talking about this idea of marginal utility of a feature given that you have selected one feature already. We are acting as if all features are independent of each other given class, so you can just pick the top K features. But really, once I already picked Viagra, maybe, what is that, Cialis is not as indicative anymore if Viagra is being taken into consideration already. Okay, that is the inter-feature interaction. So you want to ask not just what is the extra information given by this word, given this class, but you really want to ask the marginal question that now that I'm going to take into account Viagra and I'm looking for spam mails, would Cialis be a useful word to track or not? Okay? It turns out, like, for example, certain words like, certain words are together all the time, in which case, if you're taking one of them, the other one is not adding any more information. Even though, if you didn't take one of them, each of them add the same amount of information. That would be taking inter-feature interactions into account, and that sort of, again, goes back to this, even in the case of IR, we just took top K most relevant results, but I told you that that's the wrong thing to do, because if you just get copies of my same home page as the top 100 results, top 10 results, then you may not be getting the second page, the second result to be put should be far enough from the first result and close enough to the query. And that's the inter-feature interactions. Yes. Yeah, okay, so that's basically the last thing I'll talk about, okay? You saw this picture before, okay? Which is, we basically came to this place acting as if, we've forgotten the LSI part of, latent semantic indexing part of it, when we just considered each word as a feature and you're trying to decide which words to pick, okay? Now, if I want to start talking about connections between words, then really what I probably am saying is, there are some arbitrary combinations of the features, which is the number of times the word Viagra occurs plus the number of times the word Cialis occurs divided by, and minus the number of times the word computer occurs. That is a very good feature, let's say. You would not capture it well in this way. Whereas LSI kind of ideas will capture it, because LSI is changing the basis dimension. Except, when we originally looked at LSI, we basically had data like this, and we were looking for dimensions that basically a new axis, which will basically show the maximum variance among the data points. But now if I were to tell you this cloud here is class C1, this cloud here is class C2, and what I'm really interested in doing, given a new data point, is to tell whether it is class C1 or class C2. Then I can more or less do the same idea, except now I have to take the class information into account. So in fact, in this picture you can see that the primary eigenaxis would have been, if you don't have class information, would have been this. But if you have the class information and you say this is class C1, this is class C2, then the fact that these are varying hugely in this dimension, the data is varying hugely in this dimension, is of no significance. Right? I mean, if you go to middle school, right, it turns out, my son is in middle school, and if you go to middle school, it turns out that the height variation among people is the greatest. I think the Wimpy kid is in the theaters now, and, the kids are of all sizes. The maximum variation variant feature in the middle school is the height of the kid. Now, if I'm trying to figure out, are they going to have higher than 3.5 or lower than 3.5, that's the class I'm interested in, not whether they'll play basketball well or not. Okay? Then the most variant feature, unfortunately, is not the most discriminative feature for the task at hand. Okay, so in this particular case, actually, this dimension would be much better, because it is it is showing the variance across classes most. Whereas this dimension only shows the variance across data, but all this data turns out to be of the same class. And we talked about this a while back, and I said this is linear discriminant analysis, LDA. That's all I'm going to say here. That you could do LDA based feature selection. So essentially, you are reducing the dimensions, taking into account the classification task that you have on hand. Okay? That's basically the connection to LDA and LSI. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so this, I mentioned it already as to why NBC works well. You can read that. It just elaborates on the fact that what matters is not the posterior, but the relative values of the classes. And you could be correct in the relative valuation and still be quite wrong in the actual number. Okay? Let me start talking about recommender systems. And the good news, yeah, 2 more minutes we'll complete either. So we can do one of two things. Either I can complete recommender systems in the next 2 minutes, in fact there it's 7 minutes, or or I can make the homework due on Thursday, because I would not be done with recommender systems. I don't really think that you depend on my lectures to actually do your homework, but you know, I would like to have the delusion. So I would say that the homework 4 would be due on Thursday, because I will actually complete the recommender systems discussion formally by next class, and so you'll still have 1 more week. Let me just start the recommender systems discussion, and then you know we'll continue in next class. So recommender systems is you looking at things, and the system is trying to recommend other things that may be of interest to you. In the search engines, if you are looking for a particular query, then showing maybe these other query words are of possible interest to you, or these are similar pages that may be of interest to you. Those are recommender systems too. Okay, but you can also do recommender systems in like not just text search, but also items. Like for example, if you're buying books, then you bought some books, and then Amazon will try to tell you maybe you are interested in this other book. Okay, largely the recommender systems depend on the two types of recommendation systems, and we'll come back to that next class. But one idea in recommending items for you to buy or to see if it's a movie is content based. That basically analyzes the content of the item. So if it's a book, then it analyzes the words occurring in the abstract of the book, the cover of the book, title of the book, etc., and say, look, since you bought lots of books with the word computer and science in them, here is one more book with the word computer and science in them. I'm sure you're interested in buying it. You bought lots of books on P equal to NP, then here's one more book for you. Okay, so that's content-based recommendation system. The other is collaborative recommendation systems, where it will say, look, your buying habits seem to be very similar to Joe and Jill and Rao and somebody else buying habits, because they bought these things, you bought these things. What's interesting is they bought some more things that you haven't yet bought. Okay, so out of the goodness of our heart, we will let you buy those things also, so that you would be really like Rao and Jill and Joe. Okay, so collaborative filtering is automated way to keep up with the Joneses, because Amazon will tell you how to keep up with the Joneses. Okay, that's collaborative filtering. Now in the case of collaborative filtering, you know, content based basically is classification. So the idea is, if you bought a bunch of books, so each book you bought is a training example. So here is the description of the book, the words occurring in the title, cover page, etc., and yes, I bought it. Here are a bunch of books that I looked at but didn't buy. So positives and negatives. Okay, based on that, I will learn a naive-based classifier. Then whenever a new publisher, you know, issues a new book, Amazon quickly checks whether that book would be more likely to be relevant to you than not. If it's more likely to be relevant, it'll say, why don't you buy it? That's content-based. Okay, content-based is completely classification technique. So I would spend less time about them in the next class. The thing that I want to spend more time is collaborative recommendation systems, where essentially you are recommending these items because other people, like this customer, have bought those items. One interesting thing, of course, and if you want to do collaborative recommendation systems, then it's a two-step process. First, given the user, you need to identify other customers who have the same buying habits as this user, or the same tastes as this user. And let's say you identified K of them, then the top 4 of them, you might say, are the most neighborly to this person. And then if they have bought a particular item, then you can come and tell this customer, you might be interested in this item too. Okay, that's the collaborative filtering. The interesting question, interesting difference between collaborative and content-based, there are all sorts of interesting differences. In fact, you want to think about it before you even come to the next class. But one is the following thing. Suppose I've learned a very, very good content-based recommender system for books. Will it be of any help in recommending CDs? Will it be of any help in recommending cars? Will it be of any help in recommending furniture? Will it be of any help in recommending anything else? No, because each is based on a separate content. On the other hand, collaborative filtering basically can just transcend classes of items. But another way of looking at it is, collaborative filtering has no clue what it is recommending. It's like these are all, you know, so it thinks users are like documents, items are like words, and since you have these words, you probably want to also have these words. So on one hand, collaborative filtering is completely oblivious of the items that it's recommending. And if you ever ask it, can you explain why you are recommending it to me, it always would say, well, people like you seem to be buying it. It's the same exact explanation. Whereas a content-based one could say, because you bought X and Y and Z books, they have the following words, and this new book also has the following words, so I thought you would be interested. Okay? So collaborative filtering has a much bigger reach, but it basically has no understanding of the items under consideration. Content-based has a lot of understanding of the items under consideration, but doesn't, you know, generalize over item classes. Okay? And so we'll talk about collaborative filtering first, and then talk about how to combine both content-based and collaborative filtering.